Thank you, everyone. We're going to get started here. And members, we're trying to get a lot done in a real short period of time. So we're going to go right to the Department of Revenue bill. And I'm not sure, Ms. Moser, who's going to start. If you could come on down, and I'll go ahead and move the bill. I guess I don't know the number.
What bill are we doing?
And this is House File 3149, and I'll move that, members. This is the Department of Revenue bill today. So we're going to watch it as a courtesy, and we'll try to take questions last, and then objections members have, they should let us know so we can decide what would go in the final omnibus bill. So with that, Mr. Haugen, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Haugen from the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'll be going over Article 1 of the department bill. Most of the changes in the department bill are either technical or they're small policy or substantive provisions that hopefully are non-controversial. With that, I'll start with Article 1, which is the individual and corporate franchise tax. Sections 1, 4, 5, 2 are more technical than anything else. They don't really have any substantive effect. Section 1 clarifies that in the situation where you have a bunch of corporations that are part of a unitary group and one of the members of that unitary group leaves the group, that they really don't have to file their last return while they were a part of the group until the unitary group files their return. That way they don't have to mock a return up. Sections 1, 4, 5, and 7, which there's an amendment. Do you want to take that at this point?
Yeah, Mr. Haugen, is that the 1140 amendment, do you know?
Correct, Madam.
Okay, so members, to get this in the order, I guess I, as the author and Representative Simpson, would like it. Again, we're doing this as a courtesy to the department, and we're going to make changes as the committee shows necessary. I'm going to move. I guess I don't have a quorum. Were you going to just tell me that, Representative Zellers?
I was going to say it's a fun group, but it's not quite a big enough group yet.
Well, we've had some people come in and check in, and they're gone again. So, do we have a quorum yet? Is someone keeping track here? Okay, well, we'll keep going. Just keep going.
Madam Chair, I think I misspoke. I think the amendment that I want to deal with is the 3149.
Okay, we can't do that either, so we'll just keep on going.
All right, so we'll keep on going. As I said, Section 1 we've taken care of. The rest of Section 1 and 4, 5, and 7 deal with a reference to the Minnesota statute dealing with how you file combined reports. We had an incorrect site in three places in Sections 1, 4, and 5, and we're just correcting that. Section 7 was a repeal of an obsolete rule. The department is, with the amendment, is going to remove that that repealer, since we're going to do that rule change with the rulemaking process rather than going through the legislative process doing that. Section 2 deals with the definition of a foreign operating company. The current law says that you have to have, I think it's $1 million of payroll and $2 million of property in order to be a foreign operating company. Theoretically, if you had $1,000,001 or $999,000, either $1 above or $1 below or whatever, as long as you didn't hit the magic $1 million number, you couldn't be a foreign operating company. This just clarifies what everybody understands it to be, that you have to be over the $1 million and over the $2 million to be a foreign operating company. Section 3 deals with the carryover of the corporate R&D credit.
Mr. Haugen, I apologize. Was that provision you just mentioned, that was in the veto tax bill, wasn't it? Haven't we done that before? Fixed that before?
Madam,
I don't think that's new. I think there's an attempt to correct that language previously.
Madam Chair, I think that was put in last year, or 2 years ago, and it was incorrect. The way it's written, it leads to a technically ludicrous result.
Thank you.
Section 3 deals with the corporate R&D credit. What it does, and it's dealing with the carryover. For the year that you generate the R&D credit, you can use the R&D credit to offset your regular Minnesota income tax. The way the carryover is written, you could actually use the carryover of the credit in succeeding years to offset both the regular tax, the minimum fee, and the AMT. this just clarify, or more or less makes it so that both how you use it for the regular, for the first year that you generate it and how you carry it over are both the same. You can only use it to offset the regular tax. Section 4.5, we've already dealt with. Section 6 is a withholding tax provision, and the way the Minnesota current law reads, if you hire an independent contractor and that independent contractor doesn't give you an SS number, you're supposed to do back federal and state backup withholding. If they give you an SS number and it's incorrect, you probably aren't going to know that it's an incorrect SS number, you as the payor. And so they give the Internal Revenue Service, the payor gives the Internal Revenue Service that number. They can give it to the state as well. The problem is that, and then if that number is incorrect, the IRS informs the payor that that's an incorrect SS number, and the payor is supposed to do backup withholding for that independent contractor. For Minnesota purposes, we have to notify, you know, for there to be Minnesota backup withholding, we have to notify, not just the IRS, we have to notify the payor that the Social Security number is incorrect. As a practical matter, the department doesn't really have the capabilities of verifying Social Security numbers that rapidly. So what this provision does, it says that in the case where a payor is required to do federal backup withholding for these independent contractors, they have to do Minnesota backup withholding as well. Section 8 repeals two obsolete rules. One deals with the how we use the definition of gross income for the individual income tax. In that rule, there was some provision, or there were some references to the old farm loss modification and income averaging, which has gone for quite a while. The rest of the rule, that part of the rule, just deals with how you use gross income in determining whether you meet the filing requirement. That's very well covered in the Minnesota statutes already, so that it's sort of redundant, so we're getting rid of that. The other one deals with corporate declarations of estimated taxes. We haven't had declarations of estimated taxes for a long time, so we're getting rid of that rule as well. That covers the individual and corporate franchise tax, and I'll turn it over to Susan Gary, one of our attorneys for sales tax.
Okay, we have a quorum now, so I'm going to go ahead and move House File 3149 and members the amendment to get it in the form the department wanted that we pass by because we didn't have a quorum is the A08-1137 amendment, and I'll move that as well. Is there discussion to the amendment? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Amendment is adopted. Welcome.
I'm Susan Berry from the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'll go through Article 2, Sales and Use Tax. Sections 1, 2, and also Section 8 together provide that a purchaser shall be relieved from additional liability for tax, penalty, and interest when the purchaser or the purchaser's seller or the certified service provider relied on erroneous data provided by the Department of Revenue regarding tax rates, boundaries, taxing jurisdiction assignments, and the taxability matrix, all which are required by the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement. Section 3, as well as Sections 10 and 11, which are the last two sections in the article, amend the Sales Tax Chapter and the Sales Tax on Motor Vehicles Chapter to update references to the Internal Revenue Code to reflect the IRC as amended through 1231-2007. That's just a technical change. Section 4 amends the definition of state to include the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, and this would be in conformity with the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement. Section 5 gives relief to the certified service providers. Provides that to the extent a seller under the statute is relieved for liability for accepting a fully completed exemption certificate, the seller's certified service provider is also relieved of the liability. Section 6 does two things. It clarifies that the exemption for medical devices applies only for human use, just as the drugs are only for human use. And then two, given that the Minnesota exempts durable medical equipment for home use, it provides that repair and replacement parts, which are a part of the definition of durable medical equipment, includes all components or attachments used in conjunction with the equipment. It also provides that the repair and replacement parts for durable medical equipment do not include those parts which only a single patient can use. And these are all streamlined sales tax amendment provisions. Section 7, sellers and certified service providers that have automated systems in place rely on the Department of Revenue for each state they operate in to certify to the accuracy of their systems in regards to the taxability of their product category. This section provides that if the Minnesota Department of Revenue certifies that the seller's or the service provider's automated system accurately captures the taxability of products, then the seller or certified service provider will not be liable for the state for charging and collecting incorrect tax. And then it also limits the extent of the relief by providing that once we notify the seller or the certified service provider that the system's incorrectly classifying the product, they have 10 days to revise their system. Section 8 I already explained. Section 9, this goes back to what's used in sections 1, 2, and 8. It clarifies that the database files and the taxability matrix provided by the department that the sellers, the certified service providers, and the purchasers all can rely on are those that are specifically required under the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement. And then 10 and 11 I've already gone over regarding updating sites.
Thank you. Article 3, and I think we have an amendment for Article 3, is that right? And I'll move the A08-1140 amendment so we can fix the way the department would like it. Is there a discussion to the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Okay, so
morning,
Article 3, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Pat Finnegan. I'll take you through Article 3. It's the special taxes and fees article. Section 1, this begins on the bottom of page 15 of the bill. Section 1 deals with the electronic waste recycling legislation that was enacted last year. And all these provisions in Article 3 are technical amendments, and as far as I know, there's no revenue implications on any of them. The first section, the electronic waste recycling amendment, there's several references there to commissioner, and so we wanted to distinguish between the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And it also specifies certain dates when things have to be done within that legislation. Section 2 authorizes personal liability for the health impact fee. We already have that for cigarette and tobacco products taxes, and they're paid the same, paid by the same people and at the same time, so we thought we would propose this piece of legislation. The next series of sections are updates to various Internal Revenue Code references throughout the tax statutes. So sections 3, 4, 5, 8, 11, 12, 14, and 15 deal with various obsolete Internal Revenue Code references, and primarily there we're just like updating the code through the end of of 2007. The next two provisions are Minnesota Care Tax provisions. Section 6 deals with the health care provider definition, clarifies that wholesale drug distributors are excluded from the definition of health care provider. They're already subject to a Minnesota Care Tax that is imposed specifically on those entities. And it also adds a provision that excludes from tax healthcare providers who receive all their payments from other entities that have already paid the tax. Section 7 is a Minnesota Fair Use Tax provision, and it clarifies when no wholesaler is involved, the tax is imposed on the cost of the manufacturer to produce the drugs, and that's the clarifying language in the amendment that you spoke about, Madam Chair, was from Senate Counsel. Senate Counsel worked with our department and thought that we could clarify that language even a little better than what we had drafted, so that's where that language came from. Section 9 and 10 are dealing with petroleum tax exemptions. The first one is an exemption from the gasoline tax for ethanol when it's transferred between terminals. And Section 10 does the same thing for biodiesel fuel. Section 13 is the cigarette contraband provision. Last year there was a fire retardant standards and packaging requirements that were passed, and in that piece of legislation it referred that violations of those provisions are deemed contraband within the cigarette statute. So we're just listing it there in the cigarette chapter. The final provision is an insurance premium tax provision dealing with health care service plans corporations. There was a conflicting reference to how the rate of tax has to be imposed, and we've always imposed the lower rate of 1%, so we're just getting rid of the higher rate. And I think that came about a few years ago when we recodified that chapter of the law.
Thank you. That completes Article
3.
Thank you, Mr. Finnegan. And if we can just finish the articles, then we'll go to discuss them. So now we've got Mr. Sirica. Welcome to the committee, and you're going to do Article 4. Is that right? Property tax.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Section 1, 2, and 35 correct fleet references to the old Class 40 program with references to the new Class 40 program. Section 3 has to do with the Metro County wheelage tax, correcting the property tax offsets. If my memory serves, the section that's been amended here is being repealed in what's called the vetoed tax bill, so we ought to coordinate those efforts before the session is over. Sections 4 through 8, 10 through 14, 23, 26, and 29 do the same thing in this with the property tax statutes that Mr. Finnegan mentioned. It references that now just say Internal Revenue Code will now say are being updated to say Internal Revenue Code as of a certain date, and we will have to, and it provides a way so that in the future we need only make one change to update all the references in the property tax statutes. Section 9 changes the exemption determination date for personal property, manufactured homes that are taxed as personal property. Sections 15 to 22, 33, 36, and 37 make technical corrections and clarifications to the disaster credit and abatement provisions that we enacted in the special session of 2007. Section 24 clarifies that certain income tax forms that farmers submit for homestead claims are protected data. 25 makes an update for fairly convoluted provisions about who qualifies not for a homestead, agricultural homestead, for trust-owned property when the person doesn't live there but rather farms the property, and we just conform to other provisions that say a person that is a member of the family farm corporation or partnership qualifies if they're the farmer. Class 27 gives a full 1B classification to disabled persons right now. It covers before the changes making this year, it covers blind people, disabled people, and veterans. In the case of a blind person, even if the spouse is not blind, they get 100% benefit under this provision, and we're just changing the disabled and benefit thing so that they're the same. Both don't have to be disabled for the full homestead to get the benefits. 28 and 30 has to do with the rural land class that we've been working on with staff and others over the last year or two. 31 has correct the local board of assessors so that if they lose their power because they don't have a quorum or training, that they don't lose the power to have their local assessor. That's a similar to 32. 34 makes income information collected as a part of the senior citizen deferral program private data. 38 and 39 affect the local government aid appropriation. There's a number of provisions that have the effect we appropriate an amount for local government aid. Then from that amount, we deduct amounts for the state demographer and some other state costs. Those amounts never go out of the general fund, so the effect is that local government aid appropriation is just lower by these amounts, and nothing ever happens to those amounts. So we're just proposing to cut out the two-step and do a one-step where the appropriation for local aid would be a little bit smaller. That's the end of Article 4.
Thank you. And Mr. Peterson, you're here to do Article 5. Is that right?
Yes.
And if I may just say, we're gonna finish the whole summary here and then get to questions. I think this article, and there's a few other things we've already passed that would have to be rejiggered if we pass the tax bill that already left this committee, went through Ways and Means, and will be on the floor tomorrow. So there'll be some changes needed. But I think the next article, Article 5, particularly with the legislative auditor's report, this committee will probably spend time on again this year. So I don't, you know, how I think this article will be a little tougher to work with, and I know that there are members on both sides of the aisle who are introducing legislation this year on this on Job Z. But let's just hear what the department has to tell us about this.
Okay, thank you. My name's Mark Peterson. I'm with the Department of Revenue, and I'll go through Article 5, which really is revisions of the clawback provisions of the Job Z law. Under Job Z laws, businesses are entitled to certain income tax, corporate tax, sales, and property tax benefits. But in order to receive those benefits, they're required to make certain promises that are put into a business subsidy agreement, certain job creation goals, certain wage goals, certain capital investment goals. And they're also agreed to remain in operation for the entire zone duration, which is through 2015. If they fail to live up to those obligations, there are consequences, and that's what this proposal is about. Under current law, generally the consequences are that they're no longer eligible for future benefits, and they're also subject to having to repay 2 years' worth of the benefits. And what these changes are doing is making it clear who is subject to clawback, also makes clear what taxes have to be repaid, makes clear when the ability to receive future benefits starts, and it also contains a reporting requirement that should make it easier for revenue to learn that a business is no longer eligible for benefits and therefore subject to the clawback provision. For the most part, these changes do address some concerns raised in the legislative audit report. I wouldn't say that these were in direct response to that because we actually were working on most of this before the legislature came to the department. But what happens is that Section 1 amends the current clawback laws in several different ways. The most important of which is that it makes this particular section no longer applicable to businesses that are still operating in the zone but are doing so in violation of their business subsidy agreement. So these would be businesses that promised 30 jobs, they've delivered 20. They would no longer be subject to this clawback provision. There would be other consequences I'll discuss in a couple minutes. What this also does is it clarifies that businesses that receive, or persons that receive Job Z benefits without having to sign the business subsidy agreement are subject to the clawback provisions. In particular, those are mainly owners of property that get a rental tax, rental income deduction for renting property to an operating business. And also get a property tax exemption or a sales tax exemption on the construction materials. Now, those businesses also would be entitled to a waiver of the clawback of forgiveness, wouldn't have to repay if the underlying operating business had their clawback waived, or if the business is not related to the operating business, there'd be a waiver unless the owner of the property was in some way responsible for the operating business no longer being able to operate in the zone. We're also doing a change, making clear when the two-year period starts. In the current law, it's not really clear where the two-year period starts, so we're making it clear that for sales tax, it's all the purchases they make before they close down, subject to recapture or repayment. Income tax is the two full tax years before the business shuts down. And for property taxes, the repayment would be for the year the business closes and for the prior year. It also makes very clear that businesses can't claim any benefits for periods after they've closed down or no longer operating in the zone. Section 2 is the provision that says what happens if the business agreed or is no longer operating, still operating in a zone, but no longer operating compliance with its business subsidy agreement. What it says is that this business doesn't get any future benefits, but they don't have to repay the benefits. If they want to get back into the program, they can do that. What they have to do is that they have to sign a new or an amended business subsidy agreement. Before that can become effective, though, the business in the community will need to go to deed and get the zone duration changed so that the business will not get as many years benefits as they would have originally if they'd lived up to the first agreement. Deed will reduce the zone duration by at least 1 year and potentially more based on the level of performance that the business has had under the original business subsidy agreement. Once that zone duration has been changed, if the business doesn't live up to the second agreement, it can't go through that process again and get the zone duration changed, either longer or shorter, and would be subject to clawback for the 2 years with the benefits. Section 3 is simply prohibits amendments to the business subsidy agreement to get around clawback. The exception that they could, of course, do the amended or new agreement if they've already had the zone duration or if they're seeking to get the zone duration shortened under the provision I just mentioned. And the section 4 is an annual certification of compliance. And what this will do is by December 1 of each year, each business operating in a zone will have to send a statement to the Commissioner of Deeds that says, yes, I am still operating in a zone, and yes, I am still in compliance with my business subsidy agreement. That's what we're envisioning, is that it would be a pretty short little form. It's not really, they're not really sending a lot of documentation. It's a self-reporting, but the consequence for failing to send this in ultimately is that they're removed from the program and subject to clawback. Additionally, for those businesses that are still operating in the zone but they're not in compliance, if they say that they are and they aren't, rather than having new consequence that I just explained to those businesses, they would be subject to immediate clawback and they'd be permanently removed from the program. So we think that that's going to really help us get information in a really timely way on whether these businesses are operating in the zone and still entitled to benefits.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And now, is it Tuig?
Tuig,
yes. Welcome. And you're doing Article 6. Thank you.
My name is Joan Tuig, and I'm doing Article 6. Sections 1 and 2 of Article 6. 6 amend 16B02 to allow cities and counties to refer debts to the Commissioner for Collection, and also clarifies that state-supported schools, in addition to the University of Minnesota, can refer debts to the Commissioner for Collection. Section 3 amends Minnesota Statute 16-04 to authorize the Commissioner to make the determination of whether a debt that has been referred to the Commissioner for Collection is uncollectible. Section 4 amends 270-08 to clarify that when debts that have been referred to the Commissioner for Collection, notice to the debtor of revenue recapture will be sufficient if the Commissioner sends the notice by regular mail to the debtor's last known address. And it also changes the reference in that subdivision to current address to last known address. That's the more appropriate term to use. And finally, Section 5 is a technical provision that clarifies that the prohibition against collection during the appeal period of an order applies to all orders where liability is being imposed, and not just orders of assessment as it's currently provided. That was something that, some language that was not picked up during the recodification. So that's the way it has been in the past. And that's Article 6.
Thank you. Okay, so thank all six of you, for your presentations on articles. And so questions from members. I think it's fair to say that Article 5, we probably can't get too into that today since we're going to have to... the committee will just have a lot of debate about that, but a lot of the summary appears to be technical. There are some substantive pieces as well. So, Representative Ela Forrest.
If Mr. Finnegan could come back up to the stand, I did have a question about, I think it's Article 3, Section 2, regarding the imposition of personal liability.
Mr. Finnegan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Finnegan, can you give me a bit more context to this issue, please?
Madam Chair, Representative, there's certain taxes that the Commissioner has authority to impose personal liability for, and it's normally someone who has, it's an officer of the corporation who has some sort of control over the income of the corporation. You know, it's usually the treasurer, the financial person. And what we're doing here is just seeking authority to, we already have authority to impose personal liability in the cigarette tax area. It's on the distributors who pay the tax. The health impact fee is paid at the same time by the distributors, and it was one of our auditors just proposed, well, why don't we have the same ability to assess the officers personally for the health impact fee? And that's what that proposal does.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Finnegan, I mean, generally the public policy of the state is to allow for that limited liability shield, a corporate veil, if you will, to protect the corporation. What is the public policy for having what really is a sort of a prima facie piercing of the corporate veil in these instances, which is really contrary to at least the general public policy of the state?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that historically it started out with the trust taxes, primarily with sales tax and withholding tax. So the taxes were collected in trust for the state, and if they weren't turned over, we were given authority to seek personal liability for those people that are responsible. And it's just extended. I don't know, the cigarette tax and the health impact fees, they are not technically trust taxes, but it's on the same rationale where that tax or that fee is collected in trust for the state, and if it's not turned over to us, we'd like the authority to go after those people individually.
Madam Chair, thank you. I did have one question on one other issue after that, if you would indulge me, but I'll leave it at this. I mean, this is a change. I mean, I appreciate the argument that it's in the same universe of what is currently accepted for the imposition of personal liability, Madam Chair, but I would submit to my colleagues here, this ought to go perhaps to Chairman Mulley's committee. I mean, we're talking about a deprivation of liberty here when we impose personal liability on somebody. And it ought to at least go to a committee of jurisdiction where we address these issues in detail. I mean, I really see this as more of a justice issue than a tax issue. And I would hope that it at least go to one of those committees where we can consider this. I would ask you to consider that, please.
Thank you for that, and I absolutely will. I hadn't thought about it that way, and maybe the provision should be seen by Representative Mallory. So. Yes, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, I just what does it mean in this context to impose personal liability? I mean, does this just mean the person might be liable to pay it back, or does it mean criminal liability?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, it's a civil tax liability. So if the assessment is made against the corporation, we'd be given the authority to make that assessment against that individual officer and seek collection on the tax individually. It's not a criminal provision.
Further, Representative Buford.
Madam Chair, if I could, I had a question on a different article. Mm-hmm. I don't know if people have other questions about this or how you want to handle it, but I had a question about Article 6.
Article 6.
Go ahead.
Ms. Tewitt, I think. Yes.
And that's a question as she's taking it. Madam Chair, Ms. Tewitt, you have a provision here. I'm sorry, I don't remember which. It's Section 4, the notice by regular mail. That seems problematic in this context when we're talking about, again, some liabilities that may be due on the part of the taxpayer to have notice by regular mail. Why regular mail?
Madam Chair, the Senator, notice of regular mail, because in that case, if it's when we mail it out, if it's it will be, you know, delivered, and if it comes back to us, then we'll know that it was not delivered. And if it, if no one's there to receive it, we'll know it's a good address.
I'm trying to get my arms around this, so to speak. I mean, generally, in a lot of cases, when the government wants to get a hold of somebody for something important, we've got registered mail, for example, or other types, that there at least some proof that an effort was made to give the citizen notice. I don't know. I guess I'm not comfortable that sending something by regular mail ensures that we give the due notice to the taxpayer. Is it exceptionally burdensome or a cost issue to have some other type of notification where at least the state as well is protected and saying, you know, we've got some proof here that this was delivered, as opposed to relying on happenstance that maybe you'll get it returned sometime later saying, you know, return to sender?
That's good.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's 2 points. First of all, this is the notice that just tells the debtor that they will be put onto revenue recapture. When the refund is actually matched, then they will also receive another notice at the address where the refund were to be sent, saying that we either took this part of the refund or took it all. With certified mail, you know, there's a problem where they might not pick it up or sign for it, and it may be a good address and may not. I guess we could, change it to certified and last known address, or look into doing certified also. That would be
making my comfort. Madam Chair and colleagues, I just see it as also a benefit of the state to use a more reliable method of informing the taxpayer. I mean, I think it would also be hard for the state to demonstrate that efforts were made when you can come in and say, hey, I never got it. I think all of us in our regular lives, we get somebody else's mail on a fairly regular basis. So
okay.
I would hope that I just think it would work better for everybody involved to use a more reliable method to inform the taxpayers that they're about to go on double secret probation with the Department of Revenue.
Reverend West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to address that point as well, I can't imagine what the result would be if we started taking this tack across the board in committees. I know for a fact in the Criminal Law Committee, for example, with driver's license revocations or suspensions, we routinely send out to the address that they have on file. If we had to start doing certified on that thing, I couldn't get a conviction to save my life in that situation. So I can't imagine switching everything to certified. I think would be unreasonably onerous. And maybe Representative DeLaForce has a point, but I do know that if we took this down the logical path, there's no way government could handle it.
Further discussion on this point. And Ms. Tewitz, I think we've got, maybe you can take a shot at trying to incorporate the thoughts of everyone here and see if there's some more assurances you can provide for Representative DeLaForce on this matter before we actually vote on all these provisions for the omnibus tax bill. And of course, all members should let Representative Simpson and I know if there's pieces in the department bill that you object to or would like change, try to let us know, because it's been the history of this committee to scrutinize the wishes of the Department of Revenue, and really, you know, usually we tend to remove things that are really just a big problem for the committee. Representative Simpson, do you have a point on that?
Actually, just another question on Article 6, and maybe I'm just reading into this and questioning it. Under the subsection debt, the word services included, and then you go a little farther down, it's local government units. So does that mean a local government can apply for payment for utilities under this provision?
Ms. Twitch.
Madam Chair, Representative, are you referring to sections 1 and 2 as changed to allow cities and counties to use this? That section would allow any debts that are open to cities and counties to use this commissioner for collection. If they
Representative Simpson?
I'm not sure if I'm following that or not. I guess what I'm referring to is a municipal gas system, a municipal electric system, and the city gets stuck with a bill of $1,000. Would this provision, would this be able to work through this provision to collect that?
Madam Chair,
what I'm asking is.
Representative, yes.
That's good.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Rep. Maury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First thing is, I think I probably agree with Representative De La Forest, except I also think that his colleagues on that side of the aisle don't think that should apply to insurance companies, which I think it should. So I think we should treat them likewise. I have a question, though, for the chair. Are we not ask questions about five, or should we just hold those off for some other?
No, that's fine. I was trying to get a heads up to the department that it's unlikely that that one would just go in the bill, as the department is recommending, and I think the department is somewhat responding to what's out there, but we haven't even had the hearing yet on the legislative auditor's report on jobs, which this committee will do. So, Representative Mallory.
Well, I was just going to ask what justification there was for changing the clawback. I certainly don't agree with saying that reducing the powers of the clawback and, in fact, negating the clawback. I don't think we do that for any other of the corporate welfare provisions in our clawback clause. So why are we suddenly doing it in this case? And maybe there's nobody going to want to answer that. Or
let's see, who was
there's not
Mr.
a rush
Peterson?
For the mic.
I'm not sure whether Mr. Peterson on this article. Yes, welcome again. Mr. Manson, you look like you're getting roped in on this. Heard you were over at the Senate. How's that tax bill going?
Madam Chair, that's going to take a while, I think.
Okay, Mr. Manson.
Madam Chair and Representative Mallory, regarding the changes in Article 5 for the jobs and zones, obviously this is our proposal. We realize that this has been around for like 3-4 years, and this program needs to be looked at and changes need to be made. This is our proposal, and I think you're talking about doing away with the clawback for those businesses that continue to operate in the zone. I think that's kind of our proposal. And it's really, it's a call for the members here, but you've got businesses that promised, up to 30 jobs or something, and you get like within a couple of 3 of those. Do you really want to kick them out of the program and claw back the benefits they got, or you want to kind of work with them, maybe amend the business subsidy agreement, maybe shorten up their benefits at the end of the zone duration instead? So that's kind of the way we look at it. So they're still operating, they're still providing a lot of good jobs for the community, and you really want to kick them out? Is that in the best interest of the state, or do you want to kind of work with them? And they're going to lose some benefits, but kind of prorated on how close they came to their goals. So rather than just drawing a line in the sand that, you got to hit it exactly, or there's no problem.
That was sure.
Rep. Maury.
Thank you. Follow up. I have trouble buying into your argument, but second of all, do we do that for all our other corporate welfare callback provisions and law?
And Madam Chair, Representative Maury, that's probably a better question for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. That deals a lot with the business subsidy laws, so I don't know. We're probably not the best person to answer that, but.
Rep. Maury.
I mean, you're coming in with something. I'd like to have kind of a standard approach by the state to different things, so I think we should know that when you're coming in and asking for something.
And Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, as Madam Chair mentioned earlier, we believe this is going to also be part of a larger bill that's going to deal with both Steve's issues and our issues as a result of legislative auditor's report. I think there'll be more discussion in this area, but it's kind of what we worked on even before the auditor's report to kind of tie up some of these loose ends that we believe are existing out there now. But I think there'll be a lot more discussion.
And if I may, I know Representative Simpson probably will have something either carried for the governor or for himself. And Job Z is always very active in that area. And I know Representative Gunther was carrying a bill around the floor yesterday. And I've heard a number of members who are looking to do everything from eliminate to expand, and so I think we'll get into all that when we hear the Job Z report. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to beat this to death because I do hear what the Chair is saying about this. This might not be the day to go into all this, but I just wanted to kind of comment about something I thought I heard when you were going through this really quickly, and that was under Section 4, when you're talking about, I think you said that if businesses say they're complying with the agreement and they're not, that there would be an immediate clawback in that case under this proposal. And I guess I wanted to say that I don't know if they have to sign something under oath or, you know, certify that they're complying or something, but in that case, if they say they're complying and they're not complying, I would hope there would be a more severe penalty for that than just an immediate clawback. You know, I mean, in terms of, you know, making some certification of state we're doing something and then we're not doing it. I would think that would be a more serious situation. So I just wanted to say that, put that out there for your consideration when this is redone.
Thank you for that, Representative Lieberman. Sorry, Representative Coles, I jumped right over you there.
No, that's okay, Madam Chair. I can hold off for a minute unless we're done with the job Z discussion for now. My question actually goes back to Article 6. I think Mr. Manson can answer it.
And actually hope we are done with job Z, if I may. Members, we're trying to not meet tomorrow, and we still have two big bills and a bunch of public testifiers on those big bills. So we're hoping to move on past this because this will be a part of the omnibus tax bill discussion. Representative Colt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Mr. Manson can probably help me with this one, but it goes to the questions that I'm not sure who was raising.
Representative Gila Forrest, I believe. Or Simpson.
Representative Simpson about Article 6, Section 1. Mr. Manson, how many additional employees does the department envision needing if this provision is passed into law?
Okay. Who would be the best person?
I mean, we're expanding the department's ability to collect debt on behalf of other entities. I would assume that the department would also be asking for additional FTEs to do that. Can you respond?
Madam Chair and Representative Coles, I believe we also raised that question internally as well, and we don't believe we need any new employees to handle this caseload now. And this language, I believe, is also permissive. So we're only going to do, you know, as much as we can handle to help out the cities and the other government entities we're extending this to. So if we would need more resources, then we would you know, come to the legislature and ask for that. But we would just handle as much as we could internally without requiring any more resources at this time.
Representative Coles? Okay, thank you. And members, I'm going to lay this one over then, and it'll all be back when we go on to the omnibus tax bill later this year. Provisions that we all like will get folded in, and provisions we don't like won't be in the bill. So we'll talk about that further. I do want to say that Representative Portman had to be somewhere, and we are going to hear her bill, but we will have staff just explain the provisions when we get to it. And if we can just think about Representative Earhart's bill here and Representative Portman's bill in the context of this presentation we're going to hear from Dr. Wilson. And members, some of these bills were introduced last year to expand the sales tax base and lower the rates and bring in services and kind of level the playing field between the sales tax world, take out the business input, take out pyramiding so we're doing good tax policy if we could ever get to this point. And it's really in a response, I think, mostly to income tax changes and demographics and the erosion of the sales tax base to look at adequate revenue for the future. And the State Budget Trends Study Group is working on this as well. But rather than having heard all these bills one by one last year, I think we were all pretty realistic we couldn't achieve this last year for those who support it, and maybe we can't this year either. But I wanted everyone to know, I have talked to the commissioner about this, I've talked to the Senate, I've talked to the governor, and there's been a lot of discussion about maybe not at this moment, but what are we going to do in the future with the sales tax base. And just to put it in historical context, when I was first a legislator, Governor Ventura proposed this, there was a lot of good in his proposal. I think there was a lot of things that were not right about that proposal, and some of it was the fact that there was a lot of business pyramiding of inputs going on, a lot of sort of double taxation. And we did spend time on this in the committee last year because the revenue estimates to do bills like these are very, very complicated. It takes the Department of Revenue months to look at what's being taxed, and if we lower the rate, what does that mean, and what isn't taxed, and if we bring them into the economy and tax them, what does that mean? And so I had asked during the interim Dr. Wilson to kind of take a shot at just informing all of us, not just members, but the public and those who follow the workings of this committee, to understand when you hear these things floated out there by Republicans, Democrats, the governor, anybody who's talking about sales, you know, we need to expand the sales tax base, broaden the base, lower the rate, what exactly are they talking about, and what might that mean? So I thought the best way to think about Representative Earhart's bill and Representative Portman's, and those would be two of many approaches, is to first ask Dr. Wilson to kind of walk us through what are we really talking about if Minnesota was really going to attempt to reform the sales tax in a you know, true reform sense. So with that, Dr. Wilson, I have not seen this presentation. I don't know what's in it, but I'm assuming it's going to be educational. Dr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Paul Wilson from the Tax Research Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I hope, Madam Chair, that I at least provide some of what you are describing. I think it'd be somewhat helpful. Appreciate this chance to talk again. I'm not testifying on behalf of any of these bills, but rather just providing background. Well, you should have a handout, this is actually a fairly short presentation, and keep time for questions, I assume, afterwards. We're looking in these bills that are to be heard, we're looking at choosing a sales tax base. We're not looking at raising sales tax revenue or reducing sales tax revenue. We're just looking at what the base should be as a revenue-neutral kind of choice. So we're talking about a broader base, lower rate as an option as compared to a narrower base and higher rate. On the diagram, if you can see, if you think about the tax at 6.5%, we have a fairly narrow base. We'll talk about how narrow it is in a minute, but fairly narrow base. But if you were to expand that base by 8.5%, you can cut the rate to 6%. In other words, if you expand the base, you bring 8.5% more into the base, you could lower the rate to 6% and raise the same amount of money. That, by the way, is approximately what Representative Earhart does in his bill. And drop the rate to just slightly below 6%. If you expand the base by 50%, you can cut the tax rate by a third all the way down to 4.33%, and that's pretty close to what Representative Portman does in her bill. And if you were to double the base to 100%, obviously you can cut the rate in half. Okay, so the question is, what's the right definition of a base if you think about the choice being a higher rate if you have the narrower base? First question maybe to address is how Minnesota's tax base compares to other states. Now, there are various ways to do this. You may have seen listings of how many states tax, how many services, and that kind of thing. I think the one possible measure is one that was introduced, it was presented in an article in September in State Tax Notes by Professor Mike Sell from the University of Indiana. It defined tax breadth as basically just the tax base as a percent of personal income. In other words, in each state, let's look at how big the tax base is and compare it to the personal income of that state to get some idea about how broad the base is. And what he found in that study, and actually not what he found, but after talking to him and correcting the Minnesota numbers, then what he found was that Minnesota ranks 30th among the 45 states for the sales tax. Our tax base is equal to about 38% of state personal income. The graphic here shows where Minnesota is relative to other states. By this measure. Now, this is not a perfect measure by any means, but it's one possible measure to sort of say, are we really a narrow base relative to how other states tax systems in other states? If you look at the states on the left, you'll notice Hawaii has more than 100%. That's because with tourism and they have a tax, a lot of pyramiding in their tax system, so their base actually exceeds their personal income. But if you look at those, the broadest, if you look at the ones on the left, the ones with the broadest sales tax base, none of them have a tax rate over 5%. If you look at the narrow tax base, it's the right, the bottom five, all of them have tax rates over 5%. So there is this choice of sort of those with a narrower base tend to have a higher rate, and those with a broader base tend to have a lower tax rate. If you were to add clothing to our tax base and just do that, we'd move from 30th to 25th, so we'd be about average. So you don't want to think about Minnesota as having a tax base that is particularly narrow. It's not unusually narrow except for clothing. And yet it's not, it's just average, okay, other than the closing issue. House Bill 2631, Representative Portman's bill, if you did that, we'd move up to about 11th on this ranking. So we'd become one of the broadest, relatively one of the broadest tax bases in the country. So we're talking about fairly major changes in where we would rank compared to the states in looking at least the latter bill. I want to point out that the rank can be high for good and bad reasons. If the rank is high in terms of breadth, it may just mean you're taxing a whole bunch of business services and business purchases. So the rank can be high either because more consumer purchases in the base or because more business purchases are taxable. And broadening the base just by bringing in more business purchases is something we've been working against that. So we've really been narrowing the base. In a sense, a narrower base may be good in some sense. Not all base broadening is created equal in terms of the goals of it. Just a little bit of history in Minnesota of how our base has changed. We've done, as I said, a lot to expand the exemptions of business inputs in Minnesota. Capital equipment, replacement capital equipment, and manufacturing, those were in the tax base originally, and they have been taken out first at lower rates and now taken out of the base. Accessory tools, special tooling, farm machinery, and materials used in providing taxable services a few years ago were also exempted from tax. So if your service is taxed, you wouldn't be paying tax on the inputs into producing that service. If you think of the sales tax as a consumption tax, then it makes sense to exempt business inputs. Not all people think of the sales tax in that way. So, but that's the purpose of that is you reduce pyramiding, and you don't tax the grain and then tax the flour and then tax the bread and then tax the groceries for a purchase, which is a pyramiding kind of thing if you exempt the business inputs in the process. Early changes for consumers were after sales tax was first, when the first sales tax was first introduced in Minnesota, we taxed residential heat and water services. They were exempted in 1978-79. We did not tax candy and soft drinks when the sales tax came into effect. But in the early 80s, we started taxing candy and soft drinks, cable TV, and over-the-counter magazines, among others. But the big changes in the tax base, if you really look at the tax base history, the big changes were 1987. If you really want to talk about any time we made changes other than the capital equipment type of thing that were significant, 1987 services were probably the time to look at. At that time, we brought into the tax base parking, motor vehicle cleaning, pet grooming, laundry, dry cleaning, building cleaning, exterminating services, detective security services, lawn and garden services, non-prescription drugs, which of course has gone the other way since then. Interstate telephone service, most club dues, admission to health clubs, meal service and hospital cafeterias, and then 1991, pet sorting and private communication services. I believe, and Pat Dalton may shake her head one day, I believe in both, in all these cases, this is an attempt to raise revenue. It was base expansion, not to broaden the base and lower the rate, but base expansion to pick up more revenue in each of these cases. The chair mentioned Governor Ventura's proposal in 2001. Just a couple words on that. It would have been an extensive increase in the base of the sales tax. If you look at just the base expansion parts of that proposal, of his big plan on sales tax, it would have increased the base by 22%. The difference between that and what's being proposed, the bills you will hear later, is that Ventura's proposal was primarily a tax on business services. 64%, we estimated 64% of the increased base would have been a tax on business purchases, only 36% on consumer purchases. This would have increased the business share of the sales tax. It was one reason why there was some opposition, at least, to that. Just realize how different that is from what you will be seeing in the bills heard later. He included in his proposal almost all professional services, legal, accounting, architecture, management, personnel services, R&D services, all were included in that proposal. Many of those are, they're primarily business purchases, and there was no carve-out for business purchases. He also included special trade construction services in the original proposal as an attempt to tax some construction labor as well as just the construction materials in that sector. Governor Ventura's proposal did not include a couple of things that are noteworthy. He did not include clothing in his base broadening proposal. We did not include prescription drugs. We did not include motor fuels or residential heating fuels. That's, again, in contrast to some of the proposals you'll see later. His proposal was not revenue neutral. He broadened the base and lowered the rate, but he took some money out in the process. The impact of the full proposal, including a bunch of other things in it, would have been to raise sales tax revenue by 8 to 9%. So Ventura was base broadening, but it was base broadening on business services, and it was to lower the rate, but also to increase sales tax revenue considerably. Why should we care about the tax base? Well, one reason is, can be seen on this slide. The service sector is growing. This shows the history from 1970 to 2006 from the personal consumer expenditures. This is only the consumer part of the sales tax base, so realize we're not looking at the whole base. But the services sector, services now make up, in 1970 made up half of all personal consumption. They now make up two-thirds of personal consumption. Durable goods, and by the way, we only tax about 10% of services under current law. Durable goods have gone from 14% to 11%. That's what we tax mostly. 89% of those are taxable and are in the tax base. And non-durable goods have slid the most in percentage from 35% to 23%, and we tax 41% of them. So the sectors of the economy we tax the most under current law are shrinking, which leads to the sales tax base growing more slowly than the economy under the current law. Consumer services are growing rapidly, and again, you've got some numbers on the slide here, and they'll be on a graph in a second, the chart as well. If you look at the next chart, this chart shows again for 1970 to 2006 the percent of goods we tax and the percent of services we tax. This is actually current law, and I'm just applying current law to consumption patterns in past years. So we're not looking at law changes; we're just looking at basically consumption pattern changes through time. And it's a little uneven to say, you wonder about why it's a little wavy that way. But you can see that we've held our own on taxing the goods percentages, maybe increased it somewhat. Services have saved about 10%. But if you look at the all of consumption, you can see we have fallen from about 33 to 34% down to 28.5%. That drop means that just the shifting in consumption patterns has cut our base by about one-seventh. Okay, so our base is shrinking through time as the economy becomes more service-oriented. And again, this has the services that we now tax in this description, so this is not law change. This is just the changing consumption pattern. So one of the reasons for expanding the sales tax base is just to keep the sales tax base from shrinking in the way that it has due to those changes. The average growth rate you can see for services at 2.3%. Again, on the second left-hand side, you see personal income growth of 1.6% per year. This is per capita in real dollars. All this is per capita in real dollars, so per person adjusted for inflation. You can see the personal consumption, the blue bar there, has grown a little faster actually than personal income over this period of time. But taxable consumption has only grown by 1.2% per year. So our tax base is not keeping up with growth in the economy. And that's not necessarily bad, but it's an observation that it's, you know, tax base is just not growing as fast as personal income in the economy. Services are growing faster, durable goods are growing slowly, and non-durable goods, which you tax quite a bit, are growing almost not at all. The other thing to notice from this chart is just how much variation there is. This is variation here measured by the standard error, but which is just a measure of variability year to year. So this is just looking at the variability between years in the growth rate. You'll see personal income varies, standard deviation is 2.4%. Tax consumption varies a lot more than that. So we have a narrow tax base, and the narrowness of that also increases the variability of sales tax revenue through time. Services are much more stable. Standard deviation of only 2.5%. The variable goods are what go up and down tremendously through the business cycle with a much higher standard deviation. So what we have is a tax base that is not growing as fast as the economy and yet is much more cyclical than the economy, exaggerating in some sense the cyclical patterns. Now, there's another way of measuring this that Joel Michael, an article by Joel Michael for House Research has done, which is to talk about the tax base, the cyclical swing index. We have the SUSE index, now we have the cyclical swing index. Cyclical swing just asks how much tax base swings over the business cycle. Okay, in other words, how much is the tax base varying as we go through time from a recession, from boom time to a recession? And it's measured by taking the average growth rate in expansion years and comparing that to the average growth rate in recession years. And it's just the difference between those two that sort of is the measure of how far we rise, how far we drop through time. And I just want to point out that under current law, our swing is about 5%. This is annual, year-to-year swing, about 5%. We draw about 2.5%, the tax base grows about 2.5% in good years. It shrinks by about 2.5% in bad years. This, again, is per capita real dollars in the swing. If you expand the tax base all the way out to a very broad expansion, you can get that swing down a bit all the way to the right. If you add all the things that are listed here in the tax base, you could reduce your swing in the bad years down to a drop of only 0.8%. One reason for thinking about buying the tax base, in other words, is to reduce the cyclical nature of the sales tax. I'm not sure it's as strong a reason as others, but has been mentioned, and you can sort of measure what the effect of this would have. I don't want to, and since it's time, I don't want to go through the details to you, unless the chair wants me to, but... If you add clothing, we get lower growth, but the swing index stays about the same. The difference between a plus 2.3 and a minus 2.8 is still 5, about. So some base plotting does not reduce the swing. Some base plotting does not increase growth. Clothing incentives are not growing as fast as the economy, and they are just as unstable as the economy. Things on the second to the right-hand side, medical care, obviously, if you were to add that to the base, that's a very stable, relatively stable. It grows fast in the booms, but it doesn't drop as much in bad times. Just a couple final comments before looking at some numbers. Exempting inputs used to produce any newly taxable services should be considered to prevent the pyramiding effect. If you expand the tax base and bring more things in, you ought to at least consider whether you want to exempt the inputs into producing those new items that are expanded. This is particularly in the service area. And secondly, I know that both bills create tax credit to offset the distributional problem of expanding the tax base. Now, if you expand the tax base and bring clothing in and take the money and use the money for spending, you're definitely going to hurt people because you're going to raise the tax. And the only point I want to make here is that if you have a revenue neutral proposal, consumers are going to benefit from the rate reduction. And they're going to benefit from the rate reduction not only in what they buy, but also indirectly in what businesses buy, because businesses will be paying a lower rate on their inputs that they take that are taxable as well. So while you can still make a case for that kind of a tax credit, the case is obviously strongest when you're actually increasing taxes. It's a weaker case when you have a revenue neutral proposal. If we look at the last page of your handout, this just tries to look at the options. This is sort of looking at what we can do and how you can look at the value in terms of base broadening of different options. At the very top, you have current law sales tax base, and you'll see that the current base is about $71 billion. These are in thousands of dollars. About $71 billion of tax base. Tax yield at 6.5% on that, and I use 2010 here because we don't have phase-in problems. They don't have numbers that vary from our revenue estimates on the bills, so 2009 had some phase-ins in some of those bills, so this is 2010. We raised about $4.6 billion in sales tax at the 6.5% rate. There's a little more than that because of the higher rates on alcohol. If you look down at the first line, then these are services that are added to tax base in House File 2163. General repair would broaden the base by $3 billion. The tax yield on that, going to the next column, the tax yield 2010 at 6.5% rate would be $196 million. That's the number you would see in the tax expenditure budget, $196 million of additional revenue. A revenue neutral tax rate, if that's all you did, you just brought those in, you could drop the rate from 6.5% to 6.24%. So the next column, revenue neutral tax rate, basically says you could drop it 6.24%. That's assuming you don't spend any of the revenue to create an income tax credit. That's just not at all for rate reduction. That's a reduction in tax of 0.26%. And in the right-hand column, that's just measured how much you've increased the sales tax base by. In fact, you've broadened the base by 4.25%, and that lets you drop the rate by about 0.25%. And the information, that information is then provided for each of these items, and they're listed in order from the largest to the smallest. So if you look at all the services that are added in House File 2163, and we'll look at some that aren't in there, but if you look at all those, mm-hmm. you could lower the base from the rate on those by to about 5.65% and be revenue neutral. They would have raised the base, increased the size of the base by about 15%. If you go on down the page, the rest of the page, the next part of the page in the middle looks at exemptions that are appealed in House File 2163. These are normally goods rather than services if we're exempting them. Services are by definition not taxed unless we say they're taxable. Goods are taxable unless we say they're not. So that's the distinction here between adding to the base and repealing exemptions. You'll see again that a few of these exemptions account for a lot of the money. If you do all of those exemptions, if you look at the bottom of what I've got on the screen at least, the total state expansion, House File 2163, you can see that that bill would raise the increase the base by about 50%. So by increasing the base by about 50%, you could lower the rate by about a third down to about 4.35%. Again, the bill does a little less than that because it has income tax credit to soften the effects on lower income households. And a couple options that we've added on here, not as suggestions, but just to note that there are two other big areas that are not included, and what would a really drastic base increase to become like South Dakota or Hawaii or and maybe we'll go a little beyond South Dakota, but Hawaii, South Dakota, Washington State, and West Virginia, some of them are very broad tax bases. What would it take to get to the broadest base here? Medical services are added here. Now, medical services already are taxed at 2% under the Minnesota Care Tax. So we actually put the number in here as an example, just assuming only 4.5% of it would be available, because presumably you're not going to put the 6.5% on top of the 2%, even if someone were to talk about doing this. Food not currently taxed. There are states that tax food. Again, you have worries about distributional effects, but if you were to tax food, that by itself lets you drop the rate by 0.89%. And so broadening the base and somehow protecting dealing with the impact of distributional impact in some other means, so that the entire system doesn't become more regressive, you could do. And especially trade contractor services, which Ventura put in his bill, are also listed here as another option. If you did all of this, you would basically double the tax base. You could cut the rate basically in half or almost in half. That's sort of the most extreme. So the choices are basically how wide do you want the tax base, and if you think of it as a revenue neutral choice, the wider the base, the lower the rate. And the secondary question is how do you deal with the distributional concerns, and in both bills, deal with them with an income tax credit, somewhat like the motor fuel credit that was passed in the bill yesterday, or over became law yesterday.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Wilson. I'm just going to take a minute and ask Representative Earhart to move the minutes of February 20th. Is that all right? Okay, discussion of the minutes. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The minutes are adopted. We are going to adjourn in 10 minutes, and we're not going to take up Representative Portman's bill because she had to go. We can do that at the next meeting, but we kind of have the understanding of what we need to do. But we do want to get through Representative Earhart's bill. So I think the best use of time is to have Representative Earhart tell us what's in his bill, and then take questions for Representative Earhart and with Dr. Wilson, because you can see this is just a big discussion piece on would we want to expand the base and what. So Representative Earhart, you're moving House File 2551.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Earhart.
Before we leave Dr. Wilson's explanation, can you give me what we're raising now? Maybe it's on this chart. I haven't quite analyzed it yet. To what we do, how much revenue we raise when we do the whole enchilada here.
And Representative Earhart, remember, I think, is this the top of the page, the yellow line?
Yeah.
Is that what you're, is that where it is?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, the yellow line at the top is the amount we raise now. But it doesn't include the extra 2.5% on alcohol and the little bit extra on motor vehicles. But I think you were asking what the total amount we raised Did that answer your question? Is that what you're saying? How much we raise now?
Madam Chair and Mr. Wilson, we raised 71, what?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, we raised, it's the second column over tax yield in 2010.
Okay.
The $71 billion is the tax base, and we taxed that at 6.5%, which gives you the $4.6 billion.
What would we then raise, Madam Chair, if we went to the extreme of taxing everything? That was my question.
Dr. Wilson, Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, if you look at the very bottom on the grand total at the bottom, it says that it's not labeled particularly well. The grand total is actually the increase in the tax base of $65 billion if you did everything. Now, this goes beyond what we're talking about in Hudson Hartman's bill. $65 billion, $66 billion, it would raise an additional 4.277.
Oh, it's not, we're not reducing, we're not shrinking to 40.
That's what you would raise, Madam Chair, Representative, that's what you would raise if you left the rate at 6.5%, which...
So, Representative Earhart, your proposal, as I understand it, is in the middle of the page, we can see exemptions repealed, is clothing, and if I understand your bill, you would raise another about $400 million a year by repealing that exemption.
Right.
But you also, similar to Representative Portman, are suggesting it should be done in a revenue-neutral fashion, so you're lowering the sales tax rate.
Right.
So there's no net new revenue, you're just expanding the base. That's
right, Madam Chair, and I had no idea what doing that would do to the whole world here, so this is the first chance I got to look at this morning when we got the revenue note. So I think that this, Madam Chair, is a discussion that we are overdue in having, and I thought let's start somewhere, and we can, I think we have almost two extremes here with Representative Hartman's bill in mind. And somewhere in between, as always, we need to compromise, and so there must be some. I think that if I remember correctly, our property taxes are now raising more money on a three-legged stool than the sales tax, and I think we got to get that back in balance.
Well, in Representative Earhart, I think you know one way for everyone to think about it is what Dr. Wilson said, and you're right. If we do nothing and we never raise the rate, we're just going to shrink. I mean, what we're taxing is diminishing, and what we're not taxing is growing. So if we just do nothing, we'll just continue to have less revenue. And if you want, you know, government to shrink, you're probably for that. So I mean, if you're looking to starve government, that'd be a good strategy to do nothing. And so certainly some people here would think that's a good idea. But I think there are these issues of setting aside how big you think government should be. Is it fair to tax part of the economy? Is it fair that durable goods and even not all durable goods pay taxes and pass them on to consumers and then services pretty much don't? And how transparent of a tax system is that? When you go get your hair cut and the tax is being paid on the scissors that's cutting your hair but not on the actual service of the haircut. I don't think the average consumer is even really aware of what's being taxed and what isn't. And so there's disparity within all the economy out there and what we're taxing. So, Representative Earhart, can you just talk a little bit about your bill, though, too, on the clothing? I think you might have someone who wants to testify for or against your bill here, but my understanding, I think you've introduced this before, and I thought Representative Dorman used to introduce this, too, and I remember hearing that if you did bring in clothing, you actually made the regressive sales tax slightly less regressive. Do you know that, if that's true, or?
No, the only people that keep the books on that are those two
people
on the corner.
Okay, so maybe, Ms. Dalton, can you tell us about the effects of taxing clothing as far as regressivity?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dr. Wilson might actually want to comment on this, but the study that had been done several years ago did show that a sales tax on clothing was slightly less regressive than the current sales tax that existed at that time. Now, I don't know if that's still true. I'm guessing it probably is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, as we have done, we have estimated the diffusion impact of the tax on clothing. It is still a regressive tax, but it's less regressive, just somewhat less regressive, not a lot less regressive, somewhat less regressive than the entire sales tax. Soup index is about 0.19, minus 0.19 versus the clothing is about minus 0.15. It would bring, if you do what Representative Earhart is proposing and you were to bring clothing into the tax base and lower the rate and make it revenue neutral, and even disregarding the tax credit, you would make the sales tax slightly less regressive.
Well, Madam Chair, there isn't much to say about this, but what this bill does is expand the sales tax rate to include clothing, and the additional revenue that's raised is used to provide a low-income tax credit and to lower the general sales tax rate to 5.96, which I just found out this morning.
Okay, and Representative Earhart, you have an amendment you wanted to offer to get it in form you wanted, the A1 amendment, is that right?
I don't think so.
That's what we're being told here. Is that correct? Do we have that? No? Well, there's a magical A1 amendment. Maybe that's to your bill, House File 2551. Does anyone know about this amendment?
Annoying Greg Davis.
Okay. Do you know, Ms. Dalton? Madam Chair, members of the committee, there were some questions about how exactly the tax, low-income tax credit, worked, and so this was kind of smoothing out that tax credit, so it's a technical amendment to the low-income tax credit. Representative Earhart, have you been convinced on your A1 amendment here that you want it to
I was back to on the phone about this, but I think I was thinking transportation money at the time. When she came in. H2551A1, and what it does is delete Subdivision 3, and where is Subdivision 3?
Subdivision 3, Section A and B. New language.
And it substitutes the limitations on that are described in the amendment.
Representative Earhart moves the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Is there a public testimony on Representative Earhart's bill? If there is, please come forward. And while someone's coming forward, I want to ask the folks who have been here during the sales tax base expansions, and I'm thinking Representative Yaros and Earhart and Carlson and Fulberg maybe. I see 1987 and 91. That's when some expansions actually happened. Were these deficit years that people were looking around for revenue?
Yeah.
Was it, you know, it finally gave people the political will to bring some in? Or, you know, what is the memory here? And I've also heard stories that the clothing tax has been a big battleground over the years, and I just wonder if some of the members who've been through this could let us know.
One of those men, I wasn't here in 87, but I think the other one was Governor Carlson's efforts to balance the budget. It was a temporary half-cent increase that the counties had to okay unless they wanted to get their LGA cut, and so they okayed it. And they got their money, and the temporary one is now still with us.
Okay.
Something like that. Is that...
Representative Carlson?
I'm trying to remember about 87, but generally you don't increase revenue unless you're trying to solve the problem.
Representative Yaros?
In 87, we had a substantial income tax cut. I remember the business departments have asked to cut it because they had trouble attracting the middle management. So, Governor Perfect proposed income tax cut. So, probably because we cut income tax, we raised the sales tax. I think that's what it was, but I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Thank you for that. Well, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Fudge Anderson. I'm President of the Minnesota Retailers Association, and thanks for the opportunity to speak today. I may not have a chance to come back when Representative Hartman presents her bill, so I do want to state for the record that our association does oppose the expansion of sales tax to business services and to gasoline, which I think is in her bill. But I want to limit my remarks to talk about the sales tax and clothing. I'm here to ask you not to do that. It's been many years since Minnesota did away with the personal property tax because of its unfairness and decided to go to a sales tax. And when doing that, in the spirit of Minnesota fairness, they decided not to tax food and clothing. And I'm hoping that the legislature will continue to keep that commitment. That promise, aside, Minnesota's benefited from, I think, the decision not to tax clothing. People actually come to this state and pay other kinds of taxes, and they come here because we don't have a sales tax on clothing. Let me tell you what Michael Norby said. Michael Norby is the third generation owner of Norby's Department Store in Detroit Lakes. You've been there, haven't you? The beautiful family-owned store, which has just celebrated its 100th anniversary. Mr. Norby told me yesterday that they try to get their spring, fall, and summer fashions into their store as quickly as possible because Detroit Lakes, the tourists come in, and they specifically know that people go out of their way to do their shopping for clothes and their shopping for back-to-school items while they're in Minnesota. So he said this is revenue they want to continue to capture in their business for they and their 20 to 25 employees. And they hope this business will be able to continue into a fourth generation. But they said times are really tough in small towns for men and women clothing stores. One of my members is a large national retailer with stores both in Moorhead and Fargo. They can track that large numbers of people come from North Dakota to Moorhead to buy clothes. And they know that because when a lot of those people decide they don't want to keep those clothes, they stay in Fargo and return them to the store there. So they can see this this big differential. In addition to that, all you have to do is go to Roseville Shopping Center on the weekend and look at all the Wisconsin plates, or talk to some of the men or women clothiers in Red Wing, which there aren't a lot of anymore, but they'll tell you that they really benefit from cross-border sales. And I can also tell you as well that the malls over the years have historically reached out to people that live outside of Minnesota to encourage them to come to Minnesota, and one of the tags they use to come here is that we don't have sales tax on clothing. So when people shop here in Minnesota for clothes, they do a lot of other shopping as well. They stay in hotels and they pay a lot of additional taxes that benefit the state and local economy. They buy countless other items that they pay sales tax on. And they also either drive their cars here or they rent cars and they pay Minnesota gas taxes while they're here. And I can only tell you that our belief is that when you balance those out, it's really a benefit to the state of Minnesota and the businesses that operate here and do business here and employ people here. We also think that no tax on clothing is a definite draw to bringing significant amount of people and revenue into Minnesota. So we hope that as you do these studies, you kind of try to balance all of that out. So on behalf of the Minnesota retailers and its members, we would ask you to continue to continue the exemption on the exemption and on sales tax exempt for clothing, and do not remove one of the huge incentives which brings people shopping into this state. But also ask you to honor the commitment that was made to Minnesotans nearly 40 years ago to not tax food and clothing. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Solander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. I'm also here to express our opposition to Representative Earhart's bill and Representative Hartman's bill, not because we're opposed to the expansion of the sales tax on clothing, but because, rather, of the discrepancy that it creates in the sales tax rate between our product and any other retail sale. In both bills, the tax rate on motor vehicles is maintained at the current level at 6.5%, while the tax rate for all other retail sales is decreased quite substantially. The only reason that motor vehicle sales are taxed in a different section of law than other retail sales is, of course, because we've constitutionally dedicated the revenues from the sale of our product to the Special Transportation Fund. While that discussion was going on, we were very careful to make sure that language linking the rate of the general sales tax to the rate of the MBEST was maintained, and that was really a concern then, and it continues to be a concern now that our product could be taxed at a different rate, really for no apparent reason. To be brief, we do feel that our product is adequately taxed if you add up all the local and state fees and the registration taxes and sales taxes. Our product is already taxed twice at the point of sale. It's taxed annually while you own the thing, and then you pay tax again every time you resell the product. So taxing us at a higher rate compared to any other retail sale, we just feel is unfair and puts us at a real disadvantage.
Thank you. There are other public testimony on Representative Earhart's bill. Anyone else from the public first? And then Representative Zellers, and we are adjourning. Members, we're going to continue to discuss this. I think when the deficit comes out, it'll keenly focus members' ability to look at, if there has to be a hole filled, we may be looking at that tax expenditure book, and we may be looking at some of the lists of these exemptions, what they produce if they're turned off. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that was from Ms. Landerwell, as long as we're up there. Based on yesterday's vote, what it's going to mean to new car sales, I could see that the new tab fee structure is going to do severe detrimental effect when it comes to buying new cars, and I was just wondering on top of the sales tax what this may do, but if we continue that, maybe fire the internet. We can continue that discussion, for the next days that we go over this.
And we will. And Representative Earhart, thank you. I'm going to lay your bill over for possible inclusive amnesty tax, but we'll come back to Hortman's and yours again next meeting. Thank you.
Where are you going?